From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, columnist David Brooks of the New York Times shares his new book, The Road to Character, and filmmaker Robert Kenner exposes the paid pundits charged with manipulating public opinion on issues like climate change in his new documentary, Merchants of Doubt. But first, Noam Chomsky is internationally recognized as one of the world's most critically engaged public intellectuals. The MIT professor of linguistics has long been an unapologetic critic of both American foreign policy and the ideological role of the mainstream media. He joins us now from MIT to talk about the seemingly innocuous elements of our socialization that promote one worldview over another. Before we start our conversation, a clip from The West Wing that I think will set this conversation up quite nicely.
The German cartographer, Mercator, originally designed this map in 1569 as a navigational tool for European sailors.
The map enlarges areas at the poles to create straight lines of constant bearing or geographic direction.
So it makes it easier to cross an ocean.
But
yes,
it distorts the relative size of nations and continents.
Are you saying the map is wrong?
Oh dear, yes. Now look at Greenland.
Okay.
Now look at Africa.
Okay.
The two land masses appear to be roughly the same size.
Yes.
Would it blow your mind if I told you that Africa is in reality 14 times larger?
Yes.
Here we have Europe drawn considerably larger than South America. When it's 6.9 million square miles, South America is almost double the size of Europe's 3.8 million.
Alaska appears three times as large as Mexico, when Mexico is larger by 0.1 million square miles.
Germany appears in the middle of the map when it's in the northernmost quarter of the Earth.
Wait, relative size is one thing, but you're telling me that Germany isn't where we think it is?
Nothing is where you think it is.
Professor Chomsky, good to have you on this program. Thank you for your time, sir.
Glad to be with you.
I think that clip, again, sets up our conversation nicely. Let me just jump right in. Why all these years later is the West better than the East, the North better than the South, Europe better than Africa? These notions continue to persist. Tell me why.
There's a generalization. We are better than they, whoever we are. So if you look through the whole history of China, one of the most ancient, most developed civilizations, which in fact was one of the centers of the world economy as late as the 18th century, China was better than everyone else. It's unfortunately a natural way of thinking, a very ugly and destructive one, but it's true. We are the West, the North, Europe, and its offshoots, not Africa. So, of course, we're better than them.
When you say it's a natural way of thinking, unpack that for me. What do you mean by a natural way of thinking?
It's not unusual for people to think that our group, whatever it is, has special traits that make it better than others. So, for example, I happen to be Jewish. If you look at the Jewish tradition, some of the leading rabbis and so on, many of them held the position that Jews are a special race above ordinary mankind. China had similar views. The North and the West had the same views, and of course it's enhanced by the imperialist history, which ended up with Europe and its offshoots conquering and controlling most of the world. Actually, this world view about, the North somehow being on top and the South being on the bottom goes way back to the origins of what's called Western civilization. So, for example, it was believed in classical times that nobody could live south of the equator because their heads would be pointed downwards. I think even St. Augustine held that view, if I remember correctly. And it carries over up to the present when Henry Kissinger says nothing important ever came from the South. He's essentially expressing a modern version of the same racist conception.
Since you mentioned Henry Kissinger, I was just about to ask, so I will now, Professor Chomsky, how our socialization, or as you might put it, how this natural way of thinking ultimately impacts and affects our foreign policy. If we think that we are better than everybody else, how does that impact and affect our foreign policy?
Oh, very definitely. You see it very clearly if you study internal documents, you know, declassified documents discussing how leaders plan things among themselves. So go back to, say, 1945, when the U.S. Pretty much took over domination of the world. It was incredibly powerful without any counterpart in history. Half the world's wealth, incomparable security, military power. So, of course, it planned detailed plans as to how to run the world. A lot of it was laid out by the State Department policy planning staff. Its head was George Kennan, one of the highly respected diplomats, one of the framers of the modern world. And he and his staff parceled out different areas of the world and described what they called their function within the U.S.-dominated system. So, for example, the function of Southeast Asia was to provide resources and raw materials for the industrial countries of Europe and the United States and so on. And when he got to Africa, he said, well, we're not that much interested in Africa, so we will hand Africa over to Europe for them to exploit, his word, for them to exploit for their reconstruction. If you look at the history of relations between Europe and Africa, some slightly different conception might come to mind, but it would never enter the thought of the planners. So the idea that Europe should exploit Africa for Europe's reconstruction passed without comment. This is just deeply embedded in the consciousness of what's sometimes called white supremacy, which is an extraordinary doctrine. Comparative scholarly studies, George Fredrickson, for example, one of the main scholars who dealt with it, concludes that in the United States, white supremacy was even more extreme than in apartheid South Africa. It's a very powerful concept here. It's buttressed by imperial domination. The more powerful you are, the more you dominate others, the more you create justifications for that in ideology and education and media and so on. If you've got your boot on someone else's neck, it's typical to provide a justification for it. We're doing it because we're right, they deserve it, we're better, and so on.
I want to come back to how we change that thinking before our conversation ends. Let me go back one more time, though, to your Kissinger reference, when Henry Kissinger said that nothing good ever came out of the South. If the Earth is a sphere, think about this, if the Earth is a sphere and we're constantly in motion, what is to be gained by drawing consistently certain countries on the top half and other countries on the bottom half? What is to be gained by that?
What's to be gained by that is a graphic representation of the fact that we are more important and better than them. We're the North, they're the South. We dominate because of our essential superiority of character, qualities, righteousness, and so on. It's a graphic manifestation of the we are better than them conception that, as I said, is unfortunately pretty natural and is enhanced, greatly enhanced by when it's associated with power. So when you actually dominate others, that enhances the natural we are better than them conceptions.
Speaking of conceptions, that is, it seems that every other day now someone else is announcing that he or she is running for president, and I suspect between now and November 2016, we will hear the term American exceptionalism over and over and over again by any other definition or expressed or espoused any other way. It's this notion, again, that we've been talking about, that the USA is all that and then some. What do you say to the American people about how we challenge our own thinking, how we reexamine our assumptions, how we expand our inventory of ideas, as it were, about this notion that we hold on to so dearly?
Well, the best way to do it is to look carefully at the facts that are easily available to us. So take the phrase American exceptionalism, which is supposed to express our unique superiority to other countries, the unique benevolence of our intention with regard to others. You get this across the spectrum. So a recent issue of the New York Review of Books, the kind of ideological journal of the left liberal intelligentsia, has an article by the former head of the Carnegie Institute for Peace saying that it's just obvious beyond discussion that the United States is unique. Other countries work for their own interests. We work for the interests of mankind. That's American exceptionalism. There are two problems with it. For one thing, it's flatly false. As soon as you look at the record, you see nothing like that is true. The second problem is it's not uniquely American. Take other great powers in their day in the sun. They had the same doctrine. England was British exceptionalism. France, it was France's civilizing mission. Anywhere you look, you find the same thing. We happen to be the world dominant power for a long time, certainly since Second World War, economically even before that. So sure, American exceptionalism is our version of the same disgraceful conception of history that's concocted by the powerful. And how do you combat it? With the facts.
Easily said, not easily done. Always pleased to be in conversation with this brilliant thinker, Noam Chomsky, challenging us to reconsider our worldview. Professor Chomsky, thanks for your time. Never enough time with you, but I'm honored to have you on this program, sir.
Thank you.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. David Brooks not only writes a column for the New York Times, he's on the Times bestseller list for his latest text. It's called The Road to Character. Brooks argues that fame and fortune should not be the measures of our lives. The lives best lived, he said, are informed by deeper values like kindness, bravery, honesty, and faithfulness. And he looks to some of the world's greatest thinkers and leaders for inspiration. David Brooks, good to have you back on this program.
Good to be back with you. And
congrats on the number one
thank you.
On the list there. Let me start by asking why you wanted to write this, or whether you felt pulled to write it.
Yeah, I felt pulled. Yeah. So occasionally you run into somebody who just radiates an inner light and inner goodness. I know many people like this, but one of the guys I met was a guy named Father Ray East, who's a Monsignor in Church in Anacostia in Washington. Mm-hmm. I just was at a dinner or lunch in Washington, some hotel function. And he just radiated a joy, just a goodness, a sweetness, a patience, just gratitude about life. Mm-hmm. And, like, he would pick me up for 6 months just to be around that guy. And I said, you know, I've achieved more career success than I ever thought I would, but I don't have that. What he's got, I don't have that. And so I wanted to know, how do you get that? And so the characters in the book, at age 20, they were not impressive. They were a mess. But by age 70, they were magnificent. They were like that. They were tranquil, integrity, goodness, patience, gratitude, and just the joyfulness, that inner light. And so I wanted to do that.
Does that mean that it does, in fact, take time to get that?
I think so. You know, it takes a couple of things. I would say even the students I deal with who are young, they hunger for it. But I think it takes some time. It takes some time to figure out your own internal criteria. There's a character in the book who, until she gets to be 30, she relies on the praise and blame from outside. But then she has what I call an agency moment, a moment where you have your own internal criteria to know when you're doing right and wrong. I think that takes a few years to build into that. So it's a gradual thing, but I think at all ages we hunger for it, whether you're 17. And I know people at 85 are done their careers, but their inner growth, they've still got a journey to go.
Mm-hmm. I'm not one of these persons, to be sure. But to those who are saying that the last thing I want to read is a book about character written by a conservative, yeah. Your response to them is what?
Yeah, I think this is below politics. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a character in there, Samuel Johnson, he has a couplet. Of all the things human hearts endure, how few are those that kings can cause and cure. So politics is important. I write about it a lot. Mm-hmm. You talk about it a lot. But in the things that matter most in our lives, it's our relationships, our love, our community, our integrity. That's at a lower level of life. And so I defend that level of life below politics. And I think one of the problems in our culture is that we are over-politicized and under-moralized. We have a lot of discussions, and I'm involved in a lot of them, on politics. But where do you go to talk about the virtues, what's important, how do you organize the things you love, how do you deal with temptation, how do you make use of suffering. You know, your show has a broad spectrum. A few shows have a broad spectrum. But mostly we're just too political, and the things that matter most to people are undiscussed in large parts of society.
Speaking of being over-politicized, you have been referred to time and again as Obama's, President Obama's favorite conservative. Is that a compliment?
I think it is. I mean, he's a smart man.
If somebody called me Ronald Reagan's favorite liberal, I'm not sure that'd be a compliment.
Really? Well, I admire President Obama. Yeah. He is President of the United States. That's pretty good. I don't know if it's true anymore, but, you know, he's 7 days older than me. I think we have some similarities in personality, though he has a lot of traits I don't have. Mm-hmm. But I enjoy talking to him. I hope he gets some pleasure out of talking to me, or has in the past. And so, you know, I think politics is a competition between partial truths. Mm-hmm. I hope conservatives have a piece of the truth, progressives have a piece of the truth, and it differs on each issue, but you should be able to talk about it.
One could argue whether or not there's any real political leadership coming out of Washington these days, period. Mm-hmm. But I think there is very little argument that we are lacking moral leadership coming out of Washington. Yeah. Talk to me about the issues raised in this book, The Road to Character, vis-a-vis the lack of moral leadership we're getting out of Washington writ large.
You know, I notice about the people I cover, I spend a lot of time around politicians, and they're their own product. They're selling themselves. Mm-hmm. And what gets lost is the inner voice. The inner voice that says what's true and what's not true. Of course, they're politicians. They have to do the spin. Mm-hmm. But to have an honest inner voice, that gets bleached away. They bleed their own propaganda. They become public figures. And they're hollowed out inside just because they're in the middle of this rotten system. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the people in the book were in politics. Francis Perkins was First Secretary of Labor under FDR. Bayard Rustin, Philip Randolph, they were in politics. They were doing civil rights. They were doing movements. George Marshall was Secretary of State. But they preserved a private space. A space where they said, listen, there are certain things I'm going to do for politics and for my cause, but there are certain things I will never compromise on. So, for example, George Marshall, who was the greatest general in World War II, he wanted to do the D-Day invasion, be the commander. But he had a code that I will never put my own ambition above the cause and the country. And so Franklin Roosevelt asked him, would you like to run the D-Day invasion? And instead of just saying yes, he said, my own personal ambitions should have no bearing on your decision. You do what's right for you. And Roosevelt asked him four times, and four times Marshall said, it's not about me, it's about you. And Roosevelt gave the job to Eisenhower, and Marshall was hurt. But that's what made Marshall Marshall, the saying, I'm ambitious, I got to worry about my own ambition, so I'm going to put a police on my ambition, I'm never going to put myself above the country.
To be sure, there's nothing wrong with ambition. I think oftentimes ambition gets a bum rap, a dirty name. So I'm ambitious, you're ambitious, nothing wrong with ambition. But how much of what's wrong with Washington today is, in fact, that the naked and raw ambition of too many persons on the Hill and in the White House too often takes precedent over what's best for the country?
I think we just don't pay attention to the other side. The book really begins with this distinction between two sets of virtues, the resume virtues and the eulogy virtues. Mm-hmm. And the resume virtues are the things we bring to the marketplace. What makes you a good journalist, a good politician, a good teacher. And they're fine. I'm for ambition, too. I'm ambitious. But the eulogy virtues are the things they say about you after you're dead, whether you're courageous, brave, capable of great love. And we just have an educational system, and we have a political system, God knows, that emphasizes the resume and just ignores the eulogy. Mm-hmm. And so people are just not articulate. They don't spend time about it. I saw a study just a couple weeks ago from Harvard. They asked 10,000 kids, junior high school kids, do your parents care more about you getting good grades or you being kind? And 80% of them said, my parents care about grades. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, as a parent, you're nagging your kid about homework and stuff. And so we've just got a culture that's all oriented toward the resume, toward the external side, and it's just not that oriented around the internal side, and so it sort of withers.
Why do you think that is the case? My sense is that each of us has the ability, how might I put this? We have the ability and the capacity, no matter what age we are, to write our own eulogies. Yeah. So you write your eulogy. That is to say, these are the things I want to be known for. Right. You write your eulogy, and then you live a life that measures up to that eulogy. So you already know 80 years ahead of time what they're going to say about you when you die because you wrote your eulogy and you went out and lived a life to measure up. Why do we then, what's happening in our culture that allows us to spend so much time, to your brilliant point, looking at the resume part but not the eulogy part?
Well, first of all, it's really competitive culture. You got to spend a lot of time in your job. Second, we live in a world of Twitter and all that. We get distracted by the shallow communication. We don't hear the soft, still voices inside. Third, we have a culture that tells us how great we are all the time. And to me, character is built not by being better than other people at something external, but being better than yourself, about confronting your own weaknesses. And so you got to look inside and say, where's my sin, to use an old-fashioned word that's gone out of fashion? And how do I spend today combating my sinfulness? And if you do that every day and you get better at combating whatever your core weakness, whether it's ego or vanity or temper, then slowly that's how character is built. It's built on self-confrontation. And I find a lot of people just don't have the words. They don't have words like sin and grace and redemption. They don't know the experiences. And this was hard for me to understand. What experiences move you to your depth? How do you, we all have moments of suffering in our life when you lose a loved one or whatever. How do you take that moment and turn it into a moral occasion so you can be better rather than shrunk and destroyed by it? How do you take love and make it something you can commit to and be better? How do you find a vocation? A lot of kids are wandering around, what's my passion? What's my passion? And so in the book, I try to take characters who've gone through these processes. Here are the activities you've got to do if you really want to be worthy of that eulogy.
You write in the book, which I found fascinating, and I think I agree with this. If grace is, if grace is an unmerited favor, there's nothing you can do to gain it or earn it. It's an unmerited favor. I've said in my own life that the only thing that's kept me from getting what I really deserve in life is grace. It is mercy, and thank God for it. But you write in the book that you think all of us are ultimately saved by grace. Unpack that for me.
As I said, if this were a just universe, there's actually a country song about this right now, we'd all be in trouble. And so we're saved by love more than we deserve. And for believers, that's the love of God, who is just an unmerited love, who comes down and accepts you. It doesn't matter. You don't have to do anything. You just have to surrender to it. And some people have trouble surrendering to it. And there's in the book, there's a story of Augustine who has to learn. He's a striver. He wants to do everything himself. He wants to conquer the world. But to receive grace, he just has to surrender. That's faithful people. But secular people who are non-believers, they can experience grace too. And we've all had this moment where we've screwed up about something, or we've suffered, and our friends have just come in around us. And I've talked to people who suffer from trauma. They've lost a child or whatever. One of the things they always say is, there were some people who were my close friends who suddenly they were not there. But then there were people I barely knew who just showed up. And that's grace. Someone you barely know, but they're, when you need them, they just show up and they're sitting with you. And so that can be a secular form. And I want to emphasize that I use a lot of religious terms. But the book's not a religious book. There's a lot of religious characters, a lot of non-religious characters. There are different avenues to this.
You talked about suffering a moment ago. As you were talking, I was thinking of the words of Dr. King, who said repeatedly that he believed that unearned suffering is redemptive. We all suffer in life. There's no way around it. But King argued that unearned suffering is redemptive. You agree with that?
Yeah, I do. I have that quote in the book. And, you know, I focus a little on him, but mostly on Bayard Rustin and Philip Randolph before him. And one of the things they understood was that even in the service of a righteous cause, you can be corrupted by it, by your own pride, by your own sense of self-righteousness. And for them, nonviolence was a way to police that. And then the thing that Rustin did, especially early in his life, he was a pacifist, and he volunteered to go to jail in World War II. And he every time there was a segregated lunchroom or whatever in the jails, he violated. He went. And they beat him. But he was pacifist, so he just sat there and took it. And he thought that suffering was something he needed to do, to not only to advance the cause, but to heal his own vanity. He was an egotist early on, and it took him a bunch of years to get over that egotism, to be able to serve in the back of the movement. But part of it was that suffering. Part of him was admitting to himself, I'm doing this, a lot of this just for myself so I can be famous, and I've got to get over that.
I believe, and it took me a long time to come to accept this, but I believe that, especially in today's world, we are all compromised and contaminated. And what I mean by that is that you can't be in the business that we're in, or pretty much any business these days, and not find yourself in compromising or in situations for people who attempt to compromise you. You write for a newspaper, And that newspaper is sponsored by some people. There are ads in that newspaper that some people think makes the newspaper compromise in its coverage. Yeah. You take my point. That whatever field of human endeavor we're in, we find ourselves being somewhat compromised, somewhat contaminated. My question is, how then do you not allow being compromised and being slightly contaminated to not cause your character to just devolve? Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, I think awareness is the key. So, like, we're both on TV, and, you know, the sentence in the book that my friends agree with is that I write, I'm paid to be a narcissistic blowhard, just to be out there broadcasting my opinions, and I sort of am. Mm-hmm. But every profession has its own temptations. If you're in sales, you're doing a little spin all the time.
Exactly.
And so, to me, the key virtue is humility. And humility is not thinking lowly of yourself. To me, the best definition of humility is radical self-awareness from a distance. Mm-hmm. The ability to see yourself from outside yourself, see your situation, and think, well, how am I strong, but how am I weak? And then my job, what challenge, career challenges is that putting in front of me? And so for in our business, there's a tendency to be in the center of attention a lot. Mm-hmm. And so we got to guard against smugness and against attention seeking. Other professions, there's a tendency to be a little too much in the background. And you got to put yourself out there. Mm-hmm. As I say in sales, you sometimes have to spin, so you got to be rigorously honest inside. And so it's a question of self-awareness, but we all live in the real world.
Yeah.
You got to compromise to manage in the real world.
Yeah. I was tickled since you used the word humility. I was tickled when I read this part in your book about humility, which you refer to as the greatest of all the virtues. I was saying to you before we came on the air here, I was laughing because I've just come off a book tour for a book I've written about my 28-year friendship with Maya Angelou, a book called My Journey with Maya, and there's a running theme through the book. I met Maya when I was just a kid, and for 28 years, we had this debate every time we talked.
Yeah.
And it started with her asking me when I was just a child, she asked me what I thought the greatest of all the virtues was. Well, my Christology says that love, the greatest of all these is love. Yeah. So I put my Christology on the table. I said love. And then I put my Kingian formulation on the table. Yeah. King is my hero. For King, it was love. So I got Jesus and King. I'm going with love. That's what I say to Maya. Maya says, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I said, well, Dr. Angelou, what's the greatest of all the virtues? And if not love? She said courage.
Yeah.
And for 28 years, we had this running debate about love versus courage. Her argument essentially was that it takes courage to love.
Yeah.
So for her, courage was the greatest of all the virtues. I raise that because I say love, Maya says courage, you say humility.
Yeah, so I'm defending my own
thing. I want to hear this,
So Jesus was pretty good on humility.
Okay.
And so was Moses.
Yes,
Moses
he was
the meekest man on earth.
That's right.
And so my view is you got to act with love and you got to act with courage. Mm-hmm. But before you can do anything, you have to understand the situation.
Yeah.
And humility is a capacity of self-awareness. It's seeing the situation. If you're pride, you're blinded.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're humble, you can see the situation. And humility then allows you to love. It allows you to be vulnerable to love. And humility hopefully allows you to be strong enough to behave with courage.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you don't see the situation right, which is humility, you can't love or courage. So I'm sticking. I'm going to join you. I'd be happy to join your debate anytime, by the way.
I wish Maya were here right now. I would love to hear her retort to that. What's funny about it was the last stop on my book tour, after talking about this for weeks everywhere, nobody really pushed back on me. They were just trying to figure out whether they thought Maya or I was correct. Yeah. Last book stop in Oakland at Marcus Books, a brother shows up and he says, Mr. Smite, I want to just take exception to one thing you said in the book. With all due respect to you and Dr. Angelou, I don't think it's love or courage. I said, brother, what is it? He said, forgiveness.
Yeah, that's a good one.
The greatest of all. He says, we can love, we can be courageous, we can be humble, but the problem with most human beings is we never find the capacity to truly forgive those who've wronged us.
Yeah, and then a lot of people live with that inability to forgive. It's not only the other person, it's for themselves.
Yeah.
I will say your debate has been going on for about 3,000 years.
It has.
It's a great debate between Athens, the Greek and Romans. Mm-hmm. They thought courage was number one, and Jerusalem, most Judeo-Christian faiths think love.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think you guys are going to settle it.
No, I don't think so either. Back to your text, though. Tell me about Adam 1 and Adam 2. I was fascinated by that.
That's a book by a guy named Joseph Soloveitchik, who was a rabbi. He wrote a book called Lonely Man of Faith in 65. It really helped me deepen my thinking. He said each of us have two sides of our nature. The internal side, which is Adam 2, which is humble, wants to be good, and then the external side, Adam 1. And so Adam 1 wants to venture forth. Adam 2 wants to return home to a family meal. Adam 1 wants to create and build things. Adam, too, wants to serve. And so both these are in our nature, both sides of us. We have an external ambitious side, an internal good side. And sometimes they're in tension. I have a friend who hires a lot of people, and he always asks this question in the job interviews. It is, name a time you told the truth and it hurt you. Mm-hmm. And he wants to know, they're sometimes willing to put Adam 2 ahead of Adam 1, their internal character ahead. And so sometimes they're in confrontation. The external Adam, the way we behave in the marketplace, it's like economics. It's straightforward. Input leads to output. Effort leads to reward. But moral logic is different. It's, as you read in the Beatitudes, it's inverse. You got to give to receive. You have to surrender something outside yourself to gain strength within yourself. You have to give up your desires to get what you crave. You have to find yourself. You have to lose yourself. And so the moral logic of life is very paradoxical. And if you're only living as Adam 1, everything's utilitarian and shrewd. You turn life into a game. And I would say from periods of my own life, you settle for a sort of moral mediocrity. You think, hey, people seem to like me. I'm not obviously hurting anybody. But slowly, you're not worthy of the eulogy you really wanted. Mm. You don't have that inner light that I talked about with Father Ray. And so I think it's necessary to focus on Adam, too, that side of life, which can go undeveloped in the rush of life.
There was a hip-hop song some years ago called Cream, Cash Rules Everything Around Me.
Yeah.
It seems to me that hip-hop song really is a good epitaph on the culture in our society right now, that cash rules everything around me. We don't identify the winners as the persons who die with the most character.
Right.
We identify the winners as the persons who die with the most cash, the most holdings, the most belongings. And if that's the way the culture is being driven, how do we get traction on a real conversation then about character and about morality?
Yeah, now it occurs to me it's commencement season.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do in our commencements is we hire people who have great careers to tell us that careers aren't important.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't hire people who aren't famous. They hire famous people.
That's exactly right.
But we all know the career gets you. And I can tell you, I'm more successful than I thought. What success does is it gives you frees you from the anxiety of feeling like a failure.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't give you anything positive. It doesn't give you positive fulfillment. And so I think the only thing we can do is have conversations about this other stuff. You can gather with friends, talk about moments of suffering in your lives and what you did about it. I think it's important to read. I always try to have one sort of spiritually uplifting book on my nightstand all the time, just so I'm in that space. If you're religious, you can go to services. If you're not, I think it's important to have sort of discussion groups just so there's a space to go to, or whether it's meditation or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I think there's a spiritual nature that we're born with. Children, you know, if they come across a dead squirrel, they want to bury it respectfully. That's just, they have an innate spiritual sense. But if it's not cultivated, it withers. And so if you're in the land of, you know, the cream where cash rules everything, then it's going to wither. And so you just have to take some effortful attention to nurture.
Situate for me the role or lack thereof of character in these culture wars that we are engaged in every day in our society.
So I think we've gotten a huge distraction away from that, away from, you know, somewhat of our churches, somewhat of our public discussion. We have, you know, people of faith and people not of faith, and they get in big debates over gay marriage. And I guess that's an important debate, but that's not really what I want religious leaders to be talking about. I'd like them to be out there talking about this stuff and what we can learn from stories, from heroes in the Bible, what can we learn from Jesus or Moses or whoever it is, or Solomon, King David. But the culture wars have just taken up this big space in our culture. And sometimes it's not the religious leader's fault. The Pope or somebody will get out there and give a long speech about the character of love and how love can develop, and then they'll have one sentence on gay marriage, and all the stories are about gay marriage. And so, you know, I'm pro-gay marriage. I believe in that cause. But sometimes I think we give the culture wars, it's like becomes a fundraising gimmick, where each side's raised some polemical issue, and then they can raise funds from their base, but distracts us from what their core mission is.
Speaking of causes, it is going to be, with all due respect to your brilliant text, it's going to be a lost cause if we can't figure out somehow a way to translate this conversation to the youth in our society.
Yeah.
I wonder, particularly given that the examples you chose are all historical figures, wonderful people, but they're all historical figures.
Yeah.
For the young folk in our society now, red, black, yellow, brown, where do they get this? Where do they see the examples in a society that is just run amok? How do we get this to the youth?
Well, you know, I think two things. First, parents can have these conversations.
If they're there. And if
exactly.
they have time.
If they have time, right. They're busy.
Yeah.
Second, you know, there are really only two ways to get character. One is through practice and habits.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you're at a charter school, like I'm a fan of KIPP Academies. And so they instill disciplined habits, how to walk down the hall, how to nod, how to be polite. I think those little bits of etiquette are nice ways to build self-discipline. And if you practice a good habit, you'll eventually get a good virtue.
Should we have a values education curriculum in our schools?
If done well.
Yeah.
It's got to be done right. And so the other way mm-hmm. is through exemplars, through heroes. And we can all point to people around us who represent certain virtues. And when you meet somebody you really admire, you just want to be like them.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I put so many biographies in there. And so I think we've got it. We can't tell our kids what to believe. But in schools or anywhere else, we can give them, say, here are 10 heroes. They're different things. Some of them are Buddhists. Some of them are Christians. Some of them are warriors. Some of them are athletes. I'm not going to tell you who to admire and who to model your life after, but pick one.
I hope our conversation with David Brooks gives you some sense of why this book is number one on the New York Times list of bestsellers. It's called The Road to Character by David Brooks, columnist for the New York Times and frequent contributor, of course, to the NewsHour on PBS. David, good to have you on. Congratulations, my friend.
Okay, thank you.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. In his documentary, Merchants of Doubt, filmmaker Robert Kenner lifts the curtain on a secretive group of charismatic spin doctors who are paid to manipulate public opinion on issues ranging from cigarettes to climate change.
There's a bit of a mystery. What do these things all have in common? All of these issues are issues that involve the need for government action. That's when a penny dropped, because then I began to realize none of this is about the science. All of this is a political debate about the role of government. So in a number of places, we actually found these people saying they see environmentalists as creeping communists. They see them as reds under the bed. They call them watermelons, green on the outside, red on the inside. And they worry that environmental regulation will be a slippery slope to socialism.
Kenner is an Emmy-winning director and producer whose 2008 documentary, Food, Inc., earned him an Academy Award nomination. He joins us now to talk about his work on Merchants of Doubt.
Sad to say, but it seems to me that in the battle of science versus showmen, the showmen are winning.
Yeah, no, there have been, these people have been very effective at creating doubt about things where there are no, you know, there is no doubt.
Uh-huh.
For 50 years, they were able to create doubt on whether cigarettes cause cancer when they knew it caused cancer.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to create doubt about asbestos, DDT, and now they're creating doubt about climate change. When there really is no doubt that CO2, man-made CO2, is heating up the atmosphere.
So Merchants of Doubt, I get the title. Who are these Merchants of Doubt? Who are these people?
Yeah. Well, many of them learn their craft in tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
As one man said, if you can do tobacco, you can do anything.
Mm-hmm.
In the 70s, they had a problem when cigarettes were causing house fires,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted to create the slow-burning cigarette, and Peter Sparber convinced people it wasn't cigarettes that caused fires, it was couches.
Mm-hmm.
And he made it a law that you had to put fire retardants, or he got a law created where you had to put fire retardants in couches that didn't prevent fires and cause cancer. So he's one of the many people that learned their craft in tobacco and profits very well from this and went on to, you know, follow the money, and that's now where climate is.
How do they get the access that they get? The experience?
Yeah.
I understand your answer. Where do they get the, how do they get the access?
Well, the problem is the media mm-hmm. has put these people on as if it's a real debate. They did it with tobacco. They did it with numbers of other issues, ozone, acid mm-hmm. rain. And now today you have people who are called adjunct professors at a think tank when they might have taken a science class or two, and they're debating PhDs. So we're sort of, it's apples and oranges, but the media is treating this like it's a debate. It's a good thing to have two sides
right.
when there are two sides, but when there aren't two sides, it becomes a problem.
How does the media, if we don't have PhDs,
yeah.
then how does the media even know what does have two sides and what doesn't have two sides, if we're trying to do our job.
Well, I think we have to investigate, you know, who are the people speaking? What's their, you know, who's paying them? Finally, the New York Times ran a good article about a scientist named Willie Soon, who is a real scientist, but it turns out he was being paid by oil and coal companies, and he was referring to his own work as deliverables to those companies. And he's one of the few legitimate scientists that's out there doubting climate change. So I think it's the job of the media to sort of look into who is the person speaking, who's paying them, and what's their own self-interest.
So I don't ask this question out of any naivete, but who is doling out most of the money here to fund these showmen, these spinsters? Yeah.
Well, depending on which issue it is, in the climate world, it's a lot of the energy companies that there's a lot of money in the ground with the oil that's there, and they don't want to leave that money behind. But there's, you know, numbers of products that, you know, pharmaceutical companies, they don't want to stop selling certain of their products, so they'll, you know, put out perhaps false information. And I think it's the job of the media to look into who's speaking and what's their interest.
That's the media. What is the role and responsibility of elected officials? I think of any number of persons. Ted Cruz comes to mind immediately because he's been talking about this on the campaign trail and making a mockery of climate change and global warming. So I just was reading some of the quotes he's made about these particular issues. And he's entitled, of course, to his opinion. And yet these are people who are responsible for caretaking the public trust, who are making a mockery of the science. So I hear your point about the responsibility the media has. But what responsibility do elected leaders have in this debate?
Yeah, one of the things that was interesting in the film is that we have numbers of Republican leaders in 2008 talking about, of course, man is contributing to climate change. So you see Romney, you see Boehner, you see McCain, one after another talking about how this is a serious issue and we have to take action. And when the Koch brothers came in and started putting a lot of big bucks out on the table, these people changed within months of that election. And the same people, you know, Boehner, who said, of course, man is responsible, a few months later was heard to be saying, it's laughable that anyone would say such a thing. So that money has helped change those politicians. But I'm optimistic that the voters are starting to see through this and start to see the effects of climate. And hopefully that will change the politicians. But I believe a lot of the politicians in Washington know this is true, but they're scared to be voted out of office and don't want to say anything. And they also want the Koch's money to run for office.
So. Now you raise an issue that I wanted to get to, so let's go there now. We've talked about the media. We've talked about these spinmeisters. We've talked about elected officials. We haven't talked about the demos, the everyday people.
Yeah.
What role and responsibility do we have in this conversation? And put another way, what does the success of these showmen say about the naivete, the ignorance, the arrogance, you fill in the blank, of the American people?
Yeah. In speaking to one of these men, Peter Sparber, I tried to convince him to come on the film and be part of the film, and I said, it's not only about tobacco, it's not only about fire retardants, but we move through numbers of subjects, including climate change. And he told me, you could take James Hansen, the world's leading climate scientist, and he said, I could take a garbage man, and I could get America to believe that garbage man knows more about science than James Hansen does. And that sent a chill up my spine. I think some of these guys are really effective, but it's tough for the public. Science, this is a hard issue. You know, tobacco, I guess, was a hard issue. You know, it's not that hard to create doubt. And some of the people who do come on the show and explain how they do what they do, I was very grateful that they were willing to share how they were able to fool the American public.
And how do they do it?
Well, one man named Mark Morano, who's very charming, very funny, very smart, said, you know, I play a scientist on television. I go on occasionally. And he said, all I have to do is create, you know, delay and stop action from happening, and I win. And he said, my job's a lot easier than trying to change and create new laws. So, you know, I think in a way it's not that hard to confuse the public when it's issues of science. But, you know, you say Ted Cruz, it's his opinion. Mm-hmm. But science is not about opinions, mm-hmm. You know, and that's where we have to draw the line. The solutions are about opinions. Mm-hmm. We can all have a great debate on whether, you know, what kind of actions we should take, whether government should be involved or not involved. And I found myself being changed by some conservative arguments. But you can't debate science. That's for scientists.
So what do you say then when Ted Cruz, a U.S. senator elected by the good people in Texas, now running for president, wants to be our leader, says that the science doesn't back up the argument that climate change is real, that global warming is real? How do you respond to a guy who looks in the camera and says the science doesn't back this up?
Yeah. No.
What do you say?
What gets quoted is this Oregon petition that was put out where they say there are 31,000 scientists who question whether climate change is real. And you start to look at the list and their names, such as Michael J. Fox or the Spice Girls or Charles Darwin, are all on this list. Mm-hmm. It's not a very well-vetted list. and in reality, there's maybe a handful of climate scientists who question whether this is real or not. And as we saw, Willie Soon was one of them who was receiving over $1 million from oil and coal companies.
But my question is different, though. When a United States senator says the science, not that people have different views about this, but he says the science does not back this argument up, how do you respond to, do you call him a liar? What do we say to Ted Cruz?
Yeah, the answer is it's not correct. The science does back it up. Yeah. It's absolutely clear that CO2, man-made CO2, is warming the Earth. And that's just a fact at this point, you know. So, and the fact that it's been made confusing is a tribute to how good some of these spin masters and, you know, doubt masters are.
The narrative on the tobacco story over time has changed. You got to completely be stuck on stupid now to not believe that tobacco. I mean, it's on the pack of cigarettes. You know, it can cause harm. It can kill you. Okay, we know that. So that narrative over years did eventually change. How do you see this narrative about the environment and the degradation being done to it? How do you see it changing over time, like the tobacco story? Do you see it changing?
Yeah, I do see it changing. I'm optimistic. Yeah. You know, I think it's become sort of a tribal issue, you know, where if my group, you know, your group thinks one thing, we think the other.
Right.
But I think groups are capable of changing. You look at the gay marriage situation in 08. It wasn't only, Republicans. Democrats were opposed. And 6-7 years later, things have changed pretty dramatically. I think things will change on this issue. And I think, you know, you look at tobacco. A judge ruled that they have to take out ads saying they lied to the American public. I wonder if one day we'll see that with the climate issue.
The film is called Merchants of Doubt, helmed by Robert Kenner. Great work, man. Good to have you on the program. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Tony Marcano is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.